from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We continue to make progress in carrying out our targeted military operations in Iraq. Last week, I authorized two limited missions, protecting our people and facilities inside of Iraq, and a humanitarian operation to help save thousands of Iraqi civilians stranded on a mountain. A week ago, we assessed that many thousands of Yazidi men, women, and children had abandoned their positions to take refuge on Mount Sinjar in a desperate attempt to avoid slaughter. We also knew that ISIL terrorists were killing and enslaving Yazidi civilians in their custody and laying siege to the mountain. Without food or water, they faced a terrible choice: starve on the mountain or be slaughtered on the ground. That's when America came to help. Over the last week, the U.S. military conducted humanitarian airdrops every night, delivering more than 114,000 meals and 35,000 gallons of fresh water. We were joined in that effort by the United Kingdom, and other allies pledged their support. Our military was able to successfully strike ISIL targets around the mountain, which improved conditions for civilians to evacuate the mountain safely. Yesterday, a small team of Americans, military and civilian, completed their review of the conditions on the mountain. They found that food and water have been reaching those in need, and that thousands of people have been evacuating safely each and every night. The civilians who remain continue to leave, aided by Kurdish forces and Yazidis who are helping to facilitate the safe passage of their families. And so the bottom line is that the situation on the mountain has greatly improved, and Americans should be very proud of our efforts, because the skill and professionalism of our military and the generosity of our people, we broke the ISIL siege of Mount Sinjar, we helped vulnerable people reach safety, and we helped save many innocent lives. Because of these efforts, we do not expect there to be an additional operation to evacuate people off the mountain, and it's unlikely that we're going to need to continue humanitarian airdrops on the mountain. The majority of the military personnel who conducted the assessment will be leaving Iraq in the coming days. And I just want to say that as Commander-in-Chief, I could not be prouder of the men and women of our military who carried out this humanitarian operation almost flawlessly. I'm very grateful to them, and I know that those who were trapped on that mountain are extraordinarily grateful as well. Now, the situation remains dire for Iraqis subject to ISIL's terror throughout the country, and this includes minorities like Yazidis and Iraqi Christians. It also includes many Sunnis, Shia, and Kurds. We're going to be working with our international partners to provide humanitarian assistance to those who are suffering in northern Iraq, wherever we have capabilities and we can carry out effective missions like the one we carried out on Mount Sinjar without committing combat troops on the ground. We obviously feel a great urge to provide some humanitarian relief to the situation, and I've been very encouraged by the interest of our international partners in helping on these kinds of efforts as well. We will continue airstrikes to protect our people and facilities in Iraq. We have increased the delivery of military assistance to Iraqi and Kurdish forces fighting ISIL on the front lines. And perhaps most importantly, we are urging Iraqis to come together to turn the tide against ISIL, above all by seizing the enormous opportunity of forming a new, inclusive government under the leadership of Prime Minister Designate Abadi. I had a chance to speak to Prime Minister Designate Abadi a few days ago, and he spoke about the need for the kind of inclusive government, a government that speaks to all the people of Iraq that is needed right now. He still has a challenging task in putting a government together, but we are modestly hopeful that the Iraqi government situation is moving in the right direction.
That was U.S. President Barack Obama on Thursday, taking a break from his vacation on Cape Cod and addressing the situation in Iraq. The president didn't take questions from the press. He left that to the State Department's deputy spokesperson, Marie Harf, at her daily press conference in Washington who made it sound as if the U.S. involvement in Iraq could be long-term and evolve into a deep engagement.
It seems as if the administration, both from the president on the record and from other officials on background in recent days, have indicated that airstrikes are going to be an open-ended project for the U.S. military because of the threat from Islamic State group. And one official in particular noted the sophisticated capabilities of these fighters, which would indicate that, okay, perhaps they lose some of their equipment and some of their people due to airstrikes, but they can find other ways to get to other parts of the country if that is indeed their intent. Given the ongoing questions about the Iraqi military's ability to regenerate itself and develop its capability in order to confront IS directly, why isn't it reasonable to assume that discussions of the sort with the Anbar governor, you know, and it's his version of events, as well as with other regional leaders across Iraq, aren't in fact happening?
I said conversations are happening, Ross. I just said they were happening about how we can best help. I said I don't have anything up here to confirm about what future action hypothetically we might take. And in terms of being open-ended, I mean, what we've been, the president was very clear that the missions he authorized were very discreet missions. And that obviously you don't put an end date, you don't want to tell the enemy, okay, we're going to pick up and stop bombing you on this date, right? When you're talking about a group that is rapidly moving forward, and in part because the situation's so fluid, right?
Right.
So I think that going forward here, the president will continue looking at the situation on the ground. He will continue making decisions based on what's our national security interest. But at the same time, really helping the Iraqis get back on their feet and fight. And I would take issue with a little bit of what you said, that the Iraqis have been able to actually regroup in some ways. They've gotten more arms, they've gotten more weapons, and they've been able to start pushing back against ISIL, particularly working with the Kurds to do that. So I think they're on the right trajectory here. We just need to help some more, and I think they need a little more time, but we'll keep working with
them. But how much territory has the Iraqi military been able to retake from IS fighters? How much?
I don't have a percentage for you, Ross.
You know, the dam is still under IS control.
That is true.
You know, there are, you know, in Fallujah, you know, I mean, there's still, you know, very
huge
real
challenges.
Gains.
Yes.
Still very real gains. I mean, the president said so himself late last week. This isn't going to be done in a matter of weeks.
I wholeheartedly agree with that.
So why isn't it reasonable to assume that there is some focused discussion on expanding U.S. airstrikes across other parts of Iraq, you know, whether or not war powers letters need to be sent? Or
we are having constant discussions internally in our own government and with the Iraqis about how we can help, what that looks like, whether that's our assistance, whether those are our weapons, whether those are our advisors, whether it's a different military mission. But the president's been very clear here that there are not going to be troops on the ground in combat roles, and that we need to be very deliberate when making decisions about where to use direct military power here. So the conversations are, I'm not saying the conversations aren't happening. I'm just saying that there's, I don't have any new decisions to outline for you about what we may or may not do.
Well, it seems a bit specious to suggest that there couldn't be any military actions because, in particular, given that Iraq does not have a standing air force with the capabilities of, for example, calling in airstrikes, it looks as if it would be left up to the U.S. to provide that backup that the Iraqi military doesn't have itself.
15 different hypotheticals. I'm not sure what the overall question you're asking here is. Are we considering a range of options? Yes. I don't know how much clearer I can be than that. And the Iraqi Air Force does have, let's step back, they do have some ability to conduct air support operations happening on the ground. They've done it with the Kurds, particularly recently, that we think has been fairly helpful. Are we considering a range of options? Yes. I'm not sure how much more clear I can be. Are we going to outline what those might look like? No.
Let me ask it this way, if I may. You said from the podium that the decisions were made heretofore in large part based on American people and American facilities in Iraq. That's why we saw the strikes against Erbil. That was the first piece of evidence used. Laying apart the humanitarian aid aspect of this right now.
That was a huge aspect of it, though, too. But yes.
Okay.
Driving the decision making.
The humanitarian aid in Sinjar.
Correct, but also taking strikes around it to make sure we could get people off. They went hand in hand.
Okay, well, yeah. Fine. I guess what I'm asking is, what do you think would change that decision-making process in terms of could the U.S. strike places other than targets where U.S. personnel and facilities are not located?
Well, on that, though, remember we have folks in Baghdad, so obviously the principle that's applied to Erbil would, of course, apply to protecting our people in Baghdad. However, we felt it was we needed to do that.
Right, but you all have said Baghdad's not under threat the way that Erbil is, but Fallujah is. So that's the distinction I'm trying to make.
Okay, so you're asking what our decision-making process internally is like about whether and when we take military action?
I'm asking what would make the decision process change at this point to attack or to launch airstrikes against a city where there are no U.S. interests?
Well, we're looking at every situation in Iraq right now where there are threats, strategically where ISIL has made gains, where the security forces of Iraq might need more support, and we will make decisions based on the threat picture, on the capabilities we have and that we can bring to bear, based on how we think we can be most helpful. And we'll continue looking at it on a day-by-day basis. There are meetings every single day looking at what more we might be able to do. And in a lot of these places, we've increased our, and I keep talking about this, but it's important, we've increased our eyes on our surveillance and reconnaissance so we can help the Iraqis with targets, help find these guys, and go after them.
Right, but that's been going on in Fallujah for months now.
It has been, and it's a really tough fight. And if people think that these things get turned around in a day, I mean, you know that better than anyone. Some of these are lengthy, tough fights.
Completely. And what could turn it around is direct U.S. military intervention.
We will keep looking at what the options are and what we think is in our interest, and we'll keep working with the Iraqis to help them fight against this threat. I just don't have more to outline for you on what the internal deliberations are like about where and when we take military action in Iraq.
Harf also addressed a report in the Wall Street Journal that the White House intervened to hold up a delivery of munitions to Israel over concerns about their use in producing civilian casualties in Gaza.
There was a report in the Wall Street Journal this morning that claimed that the White House intervened in a typical procedure of delivering munitions to Israel during Operation Protective Edge. Do you have
a
comment?
Do I have a comment? I do. And I think some of that was the tone of some of that wasn't correct, so let me go through a little bit of what our response would be, and then I'm sure there will be follow-ups. I have said many times the United States has an unshakable commitment to Israel's security. No country has done more to support their security than the United States. Just last week, the president signed a bill providing Israel an additional $225 million in Iron Dome funding during the Gaza crisis. We will continue to provide additional security assistance to Israel going forward, and let me be clear, there has been no change in policy, period. Given the crisis in Gaza, it's natural that agencies take additional care to review deliveries as part of an interagency process. That is by no means unusual, and again, does not indicate any change in policy, as I think that story sort of alluded to. And it's not a permanent change in process. Again, it represents additional care that we would take in any crisis, period.
Could you explain the rationale for the additional care that you're using right now?
During any crisis situation, we take additional steps to, through the interagency to look at deliveries. But again, deliveries have moved forward. We put more funding forward again. It's not an unusual step. I guess I'm just a little surprised by the emphasis on it.
Well, so first you mentioned that a defensive system, Iron Dome.
We have continued to provide offensive capabilities as well, as I mentioned when we talked about resupply a few weeks ago.
Was the delivery of Hellfire missiles halted by the White House or by this administration? Can you speak to that?
I can check on that specific delivery. Usually, we don't speak about specific deliveries. I can check on that one, but I was making the broader point that there's been no change in our policy towards providing Israel with this kind of support. During a crisis, we take additional care just to go over things as we would anywhere.
The lead of the Journal story says that White House and State Department officials were surprised that Israel was obtaining ammunition from the Pentagon without their approval.
I would disagree with that notion.
Okay, good. So
good.
One...
You're well, glad we're I'm, all coordinated.
I'm glad it's a clear answer. What is the normal process for deliveries of ammunition by the Pentagon to another country, and does it require the explicit approval of the White House or the State Department?
I can check on that, Arshad.
Well,
I don't know.
The Pentagon had said
when these first reports came out about mortars and and bullet piercing, armor, bullets and tear gas and other equipment, they basically said, this is a mill-to-mill relationship. We've had this relationship for a very long time.
And I repeated that from this podium.
You know, but yet, they did not say that they needed to have any oversight, not even from their own secretary, that this was a bureaucratic, long-standing relationship. And the way the journal story portrays it, it's as if, in light of a lot of the negative publicity that surrounded the story, but the story suggested that.
Well, I'm saying it doesn't.
Well, the implication, though, is that, forget about the publicity, but the implication is that there is a concern within various quarters of the administration that some of the U.S. ammunition was being used and contributed to Palestinian civilian deaths, and that is what triggered the review. Can you speak to that?
Review is a pretty technical term, and I would caution you from using that.
I think
we take additional steps to look. If there's not a review, there's a difference. At least there is, and it matters.
Well, taking a second look is reviewing to me.
We made clear publicly that we thought Israel could do more to protect civilians. We made that very clear publicly.
I understand.
We also said our goal all along was to help Israel stop the rocket attacks, prevent them, and to prevent the tunnel attacks as well. So again, we haven't. There's no hold on anything, on deliveries to Israel. We haven't changed our policy in any way.
I didn't say there was.
No, I know. I'm just responding to some of the things that are in the story. We haven't changed our policy in any way. Again, during a crisis, we take additional care to look at these issues as they move forward.
But I know you already said that. But what we're getting at here is that the implication is that the reason, in this particular instance, that extra care is being taken is because of concern in some quarters of the administration, particularly in the White House and the State Department, that some of this ammunition was being used in deaths. And that's why, don't call it a review, take it a second look, whatever you want to call it.
I'm not going to give a specific reason behind why during a crisis we would take a second look. I just made very clear that we were concerned about civilian deaths on the Palestinian
side. So if you're very concerned about civilian deaths, then you must be extra concerned that U.S. weapons are being contributing to those.
I'm just not
going to
outline the rationale behind taking a second look at some of these things.
The death of an Italian journalist and his translator in Gaza has been condemned by the head of the U.N. cultural agency, UNESCO. Derek Mbata reports from the United Nations.
The death of an Italian journalist and his translator in Gaza has been deplored by the head of the UN cultural agency, UNESCO. Associated Press journalist Simon Camilli and Ali Shehada Abu Afash are reported to have died in an explosion in the town of Beit Lahia on Wednesday. Three members of the Palestinian bomb squad who were trying to dismantle an unexploded missile also died in the incident. In a statement issued on Thursday, the Director General of UNESCO, Irina Bokova, voiced her deep concern over the death of the journalist and his translator. Ms. Bokova said the loss of individuals who brave danger to ensure that the world is kept informed of events in conflict zones affects everyone. 8 media workers have died in Gaza since the start of the conflict in July, according to UNESCO. Derek Mbata, United Nations.
Attacks by the Ukrainian military and allied militias intensified on the cities of Donetsk and Lugansk in the east of the country. RT's Maria Finoshina reports.
Kiev calls this a large-scale anti-terror operation, while anti-government fighters in the east say they're trying to liberate the region from occupiers. Yet, it's civilians who are paying the highest price. They describe what's happening on the ground and in their backyards as senseless violence. The city of Lugansk, one of the biggest in Ukraine's east, lies in ruins and is almost empty. But the artillery fire never stops.
While the shelling of the city continues, not only residential areas are being targeted. Just yesterday, a shell landed right here in the middle of this grave at one of the city's main cemeteries.
Dmitry and his family were caught in the sporadic fire when they tried to get water from a wild stream outside the city. And safety is not the only thing missing in Lugansk. All those we spoke to here told us they are in need of practically everything. Humanitarian aid provided by city authorities is not easy to get. This handwritten notice hung on a tree in one of the most shelled districts of Lugansk invites anyone who wants to flee the city to come to a designated place on any given day. Yet those who haven't got out yet don't seem in any rush to pack their bags and escape. A couple of hours after we crossed the border back into Russia, we heard that violent clashes had erupted all along the road we drove alone. And those who we just spoke to in Lugansk now find themselves trapped in the encircled city. Refnoshnati in eastern Ukraine.
Meanwhile, there have been a number of cracks developing in the U.S.-EU sanctions against Russia across Latin America following the announcement earlier this week of reciprocal sanctions by Russia against those countries imposing sanctions on Russia. Responding to a report in the London Financial Times, which said the EU is going to persuade Latin American countries not to replace its agricultural exports to Russia, Ecuador's President Rafael Correa said Tuesday, quote, "I want to immediately say that we don't need to get anybody's permission to sell products to friendly countries. As far as we know, Latin America isn't a part of the European Union," closed quote. A number of Latin American countries have announced deals with Russia to replace a variety of sanctioned items. We have this report from RT.
Now, the EU has reportedly been pressuring Latin American countries not to up their trade with Russia after Moscow's food embargo came into force. Now I'm joined by the spokesperson of the European Commission, Peter Stano, to clear up the rumors. Thank you so much, Peter, for joining us here to talk about this. Well, as we know, the Financial Times has reported that the EU is pressuring Latin America not to increase trade with Russia. How much of this is true?
Hello, good afternoon from Brussels. So first of all, the EU is not pressuring anyone. Our position is quite clear. The current situation was created by the steps of Russian Federation, which were in clear breach of international law. I'm referring to the illegal annexation of Crimea and subsequent destabilization of eastern Ukraine. So in response to this, the EU introduced sanctions. And now, as of last week, Russia introduced countermeasures.
I would have to disagree with you here, Peter, because some say that, some analysts say, the moment that sanctions against Russia are politicized. As you probably remember, people in Crimea voted to be part of Russia, so it was their democratic choice.
There have also been concerns raised about the compliance of certain U.S. corporations with the sanctions. The State Department's deputy spokesperson was asked about a joint ExxonMobil Rosneft project that is just underway.
Over the weekend, ExxonMobil started drilling in the Kara Sea as part of a long-standing relationship with Rosneft, which was sanctioned last month. And while the sanction is very narrow, it restricts the energy company from obtaining basically any U.S. Market financing for its operations. I'm wondering whether there's something untoward or unseemly about a U.S. firm still engaged with a company that has been sanctioned by the U.S. government and whose president and CEO has also been sanctioned by the U.S. government.
In this case, I would not say that. You know, we trust U.S. companies are abiding by the recent measures. As you said, it's fairly narrowly written, and trust that U.S. companies are monitor developments carefully about as they make decisions about doing business there.
What advice or guidance does the State Department provide, apart from what Treasury provides, to U.S. firms that have long-standing business relationships with persons or entities that end up being sanctioned?
Well, if the sanctions come from the State Department, then we provide all of the information for businesses about what they can and can't do. And if they come from Treasury, Treasury provides it. We basically just outline very clearly what they can and can't do under sanctions and trust that businesses will make their own decisions beyond that.
What is the follow-up or what's the supervision to make sure that U.S. companies are complying with the letter of the law?
Very robust between here and the Treasury Department at OFAC. Very robust oversight of what our companies and people are doing.
The tensions continued in Ferguson, Missouri Thursday over the killing by police last weekend of 18-year-old Michael Brown. We have this report from Press TV.
In the U.S. state of Missouri, protests over the killing of an unarmed black teenager by a white police officer have turned violent. Angry protesters hurled Molotov cocktails at police who responded with smoke bombs and tear gas. The police earlier shot and critically wounded the 19-year-old protester who pointed a handgun in their direction, rather. Protests have been held in the city of Ferguson over every night since the killing of 18-year-old Michael Brown on Saturday. Brown was shot multiple times by an officer. Eyewitnesses say that his killing was unprovoked. The demonstrators condemn police's brutality and accuse security forces of racism and discrimination against African Americans. Ferguson Police Chief says an investigation of the shooting could take weeks to complete. We're now joined by our correspondent, Colin Kemp, who's with us from Washington to give us the latest on the protest taking place in Missouri. Colin, what do you have for us?
Well, that's right. It did get very violent. It is worth noting first that police allegedly believe that Brown pointed a gun at them, or that a struggle ensued over the police officer's gun. But the reason why there's so many people that are angry and outraged over the shooting of this man was because of the fact that he was allegedly unarmed. He was an unarmed black man gunned down by police, and that's why you're seeing so many people who are upset. It'd be one thing if he had a gun and he pointed it at police. The assumption is that that person would be fired upon and instantly killed, as is part of police training. But from what an eyewitness says is that Brown had his hands up in the air when police shot and killed him. And so many stories around the nation are being revealed about black men, particularly young black men, who are unarmed and then killed by police. And that's why you're seeing so many people who are angry, so many people who are upset. Like you said, there was some rioting, there has been looting. And another reason that is fueling the anger of some of the residents there and some of the people around the nation is that journalists have also been detained who were trying to cover the ongoing violence and the rioting and what's happening in the town of Ferguson as people protest police treatment. And the reason that it's also very angering for people there is because they say this is an ongoing problem. This isn't just an isolated incident of a police officer killing one man in one incident. They say that there has been repeated examples of them being harassed by police, oppressed by police, and not being treated like the average citizen, like they should be, and protected by the police like they should be.
Colin, having in mind the recent instances of racial profiling and the excessive use of force by U.S. police, would you say that the American public are slowly losing their trust in the police system?
Yes, that is something that's been a long time in the making. But what is worth noting here is the disparity between the black community, Latino community, and the white community, and the trust for police. There has been a long-standing distrust of police within the black community because of the abuse of power. And this goes even well before these incidents that we're hearing about so much now because of people who have videotapes or because of the internet. This goes well before that, when members of the police were members of the KKK, a very racist organization that was, you know, entrenched in policing and politics, even before that. And so there has been a long, steady distrust of police because of incidents like this. Other incidents, too, where people felt like the police were not there to serve and protect them, as is the police motto, but instead to do just the opposite, which is what many people believe happened with the Michael Brown incident.
The governor of Missouri reportedly will relieve St. Louis County law enforcement from policing the ongoing demonstrations in Ferguson. And late Thursday, there were reports that the investigation will be taken over by the FBI. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.